Welcome to Meet the Professors. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. We asked a group of medical oncologists in community-based practice to present real but de-identified cases of renal cell cancer to our faculty of Dr. Robert Motzer and Dr. Nick Vogelsang. We also asked these docs to put together a list of questions they wish the faculty to address. And to begin, Dr. David Dresner presents a patient who at first diagnosis had metastatic disease.
This is a 70-year-old retired postal worker who presented with back and rib pain for a month. X-rays of his ribs showed mixed blastic-lytic lesions. A CT of the chest revealed multiple pulmonary nodules, the largest 2 centimeters. CAT scan of the abdomen revealed a 6-centimeter right renal mass with some enlarged lymph nodes. Isotopic bone scan showed multiple lesions in his ribs and spine. The patient had a 10-pound weight loss, but a good Karnofsky performance status. His MS-KCC risk status was intermediate. His urologist performed a right nephrectomy. Histology was a clear cell carcinoma. His postoperative creatinine was 2.1. He had always been in good health, so for him this was quite an emotional jolt. His wife still has never taken it very well and seems to have a lot of denial about the fact that he has cancer because he was always so healthy. He was quite active. This was not a sedentary, sickly man. And in that sense, this really took him for a real shock because the pain was rather acute and came on rather quickly.
Now, can you talk a little bit more about the pain itself and where he felt it?
Well, his biggest complaint started off in the back, but it was radiating around to the ribs, which raised concern even of spinal cord compression because he had so much radicular component to it.
And how long had that pain been evolving?
Well, he said a month, but when you talked to him, it had really been bothering him for a couple of months, but he thought it was arthritis and didn't see the need to go to a doctor. He really didn't go to physicians regularly because he was, in quotes, very healthy.
Did he have any radiation therapy to the bones?
No.
So the first maneuver here, were you involved in the decision to have his kidney taken out?
By the time I saw him, he was already scheduled.
So, Nick, can you talk a little bit about what you've heard so far and how you might be thinking through his management?
Sure. Things that came to my mind were the spinal cord compression issue, and I assume an MRI was done to make certain that there was no spinal cord compression.
And it was.
The other thing that came to mind was the histologic grade, if you will. Is it well differentiated or is it very poorly differentiated, Furman 1 or a Furman 3-4? And the other issue was any liver mets, any substantial other visceral mets. He's got bone, lung, and nodes, but no liver. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. So do we know the grade?
It was a moderate.
Moderate. Yeah. So middle 2-3, something like
right.
that. Okay.
What do you think about this first maneuver of taking the kidney out?
I think the standard is still a nephrectomy, but the Southwest Oncology Group is in the midst of designing a trial which will randomize patients to immediate nephrectomy followed by sunitinib versus a sunitinib and nephrectomy PRN. That trial has gone through the initial approval process. It hasn't yet gone to CTEP. It hasn't even made it through the executive committee yet, but there's a lot of support for such a trial because this is a typical example, is what is the role of nephrectomy in the sunitinib era? No one really knows. And now you're left with a man whose creatinine is 2.1, which may in fact alter his ability to tolerate anti-angiogenic therapy. What was his baseline creatinine? Do you remember?
Just a little over 1.
A little over 1, see.
Yeah.
So, and as Bob will probably say a little bit later, these patients with one kidney actually may not have as good a tolerance of the anti-angiogenesis as those with two. So,
but based on what you've heard, you're a 70-year-old healthy person, a lot of pain with this 6-centimeter lesion. Do you think you would have sent him to surgery?
Probably not. I would have probably gone right on to sunitinib.
Bob?
The first issue in this patient is the role for a cytoreductive nephrectomy in patients with advanced metastatic renal cancer. There was 2 large phase 3 trials that were done in a cytokine era that showed a benefit in survival in addition to interferon. Probably the interferon had no effect on their survival, so it's strictly, in my mind, a nephrectomy, yes or no question.
These are randomized studies?
These are randomized phase 3 trials.
Amazing. It seems tough to pull a study like that off.
They took a long time. One was a cooperative group study in the United States led by SWOG, and I think it took 10 years to accrue. And the other one was conducted in parallel in Europe, and it was a smaller study but had the same outcome.
Any thinking, or is there any data in terms of surgery based on how big the tumor is?
Well, I think the issue in this person would be who to select for a cytoreductive nephrectomy. For the most part, the practice has carried over from those studies. And so one question is it a tumor that can be fully resected by a urologist? So size may be a factor, but other factors to consider are, does it invade adjacent organs? And is there bulky lymph node involvement around the tumor, those are key factors. The other one in this patient is, I'm assuming his pain is related to the bone metastasis, but sometimes the pain can come from the kidney primary as well.
What was your impression there, Dave?
He had a lot of back pain. I didn't specifically think it was just related to the kidney, but it was hard to distinguish because he had a fair amount of back pain.
And how big were the nodes, and were they involved at surgery?
There was a small amount. It was not large volume, but there was nodes involved.
Nick, the other thing I would say is that the standard guidelines from the AUA, American Urologic Association, now strongly urge, if not almost demand, that all patients be considered for partial nephrectomies, which would prevent some of this creatinine problem. But again, it's an anatomic issue. Where was the primary located? Was it in the media segment, and then you really can't necessarily preserve the kidney, or is it in a pole where you could preserve the kidney? And of course, the laparoscopic versus open question still remains. Now, this was an open nephrectomy, I imagine.
It was open nephrectomy. It was not a pole lesion.
It was not a central lesion.
Yeah. Yeah. What fraction of these patients can have laparoscopic surgery?
Well, virtually all patients can have laparoscopic nephrectomies. That's not a difficult leap. Laparoscopic partials are a much more technically demanding procedure, and so not very many urologists do laparoscopic partials.
So, Bob, this patient then comes having had the nephrectomy, still having pain. What would you be thinking about at that point?
I do a CT scan to restage him following the nephrectomy. And regarding his management, it depends on the bone findings. I think he needs an MRI of his spine and a careful assessment of the degree of bone disease in the spine that's causing pain.
He did have an MR. He did not have any cord compression, but he did have damage to the multiple vertebrae.
The mainstay of treatment for renal cancer has always been localized therapy with either surgery or radiation treatment. So you have to make an individual decision on the patient whether you radiate him first and then initiate sunitinib versus manage his pain and start sunitinib. But I think that in many instances, if there's worrisome disease in the spine, then I often radiate them first and then start the sunitinib treatment.
Was that something you were thinking about?
Yeah, actually, we had talked to the radiation therapist right after surgery. He was put on a duragesic patch, which gave him such great relief that several days later he goes, I don't want radiation. It's not hurting enough. But that was an initial thought, that radiating the painful sites made most sense up front.
So can you kind of carry on in terms of what actually happened?
Well, after he stabilized from surgery, we started him on sunitinib. He would start on Zometa. After the first cycle, he developed mild hand-foot syndrome. But the most significant finding was this really severe excoriation of the scrotum. His dosing was reduced after a short delay, and then he started on the next cycle at a lower dose.
Was that pruritic, the scrotal lesion?
It wasn't as much pruritic as it was just almost ulcerative. I mean, the epidermis was just lost.
Have you seen that, Bob?
Yeah. Rarely I've seen it with sunitinib. It's a skin toxicity in the scrotum, and it's almost like the skin is coming off.
Yes.
It tends to occur in the area of the scrotum, between the scrotum and the leg area. And, I mean, we've kind of regarded it as kind of a form of the hand-foot skin reaction, just in a different area. But I've seen it's not very common.
Have you seen vulvar problems with women?
I cannot tell you that I've seen a similar finding in women with vulvar problems. No.
Have you seen the scrotal problem, Nick?
Yeah. And I've attributed it to the slightly different temperatures and maybe some drug metabolism issue. But the typical response in the hands and the feet relate, obviously, to slightly cooler extremity temperature. And the same thing probably occurs with the scrotum. I have no idea why, but it may be a drug metabolism or a drug disposition issue.
So then what happened?
Well, he continued on treatment. He experienced some diarrhea, which was not that difficult to control. He was getting Imodium. His pain eased up and was able to be switched to a middle-level opiate, just Tylenol with codeine. After 3 months, his bone pain was really a lot better. A repeat bone scan showed everything stable. CAT scan showed stability in the lung.
So no response, though, right?
Well, subjectively, his bone pain was better. He reduced his opiate.
Did you have anything objective to look at, really?
Not on the bone scan.
Anywhere else?
CAT scan of the chest really showed the spots to be stable. They were not.
How do you monitor these people, Nick, who just have bone disease? I mean, this is a common problem in all solid tumors.
Yeah, it's the same problem as everyone else has. You really can't. Bones are not considered a valuable or measurable. So you can do an MRI, and if the MRI changes, you may be able to say, well, it's less vascular, but it's not gratifying. There's no objective measure to call it.
Although in this man, it sounds like clinically it was pretty sound clear-cut he was improving, huh?
Yes.
What happened then?
He started to complain of fatigue. He was noted to be progressively anemic, started on some Procrit, which sort of dealt with that problem. He continued fairly stable for about 12 months.
Bob, what about the issue of anemia with sunitinib and renal cell?
Sunitinib causes myelosuppression, so anemia is one of the well-known side effects. It's difficult to sort it out from the anemia related to the renal cell carcinoma as well, though.
What's the pathophysiology of the anemia with renal cell? How much does it have to do with the kidney?
We don't know. I mean, it has a direct myelosuppression type effect, but
renal cell cancer itself?
No, the sunitinib.
The sunitinib.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
When you examine bevacizumab by itself, that doesn't have any bone marrow suppression, there is a faint rise in the hemoglobin level. And that was a letter to the editor in Journal of Clinical Oncology, and we have a paper in press to that same effect, that there's a very slight degree of rise, and that, I forget the mechanism, it's through hepatic synthesis of EPO. You shut down the VEGF, and the erythropoietin levels rise. So there's some mild degree of rise in hemoglobin, but that's overcome by the sunitinib-induced bone marrow suppression or the renal cancer-suppressed marrow.
So what was the next point?
Well, he continued stable through about 12 months. At that time, he complained of a headache. MRI of his brain showed a frontal solitary brain metastasis. He was seen by a neurosurgeon, and it was surgically removed. Histology was also clear cell carcinoma. That was followed by whole brain radiation. At that point, the patient was switched to sorafenib due to the progression, and he's about 14, now going on 15 months, and still clinically stable.
Any problems with the sorafenib?
None beyond what we saw before with the sunitinib. I mean, he still has some GI problems with it.
So it's been a couple years now. What's his overall quality of life been like?
Most of the time, pretty good. He has fatigue. He has bowel issues, but his pain is still very well controlled.
Is he on pain medications?
Yeah. It's all low-grade pain medication, something between either Vicodin or Tylenol with codeine. He has not required major opiates.
So, Bob, the most common question we got from these docs is the sequencing of the newer agents. In this case, the patient's going from sunitinib to sorafenib. What do we know right now about responses to different agents, second, third-line setting?
There's not a lot of good data that establish the level of efficacy of sorafenib following sunitinib. From listening to this case, I think that another possibility would have been to treat the brain metastasis and just keep them on the sunitinib since the brain is a sanctuary site. I'm not sure that switching to sorafenib makes a difference over keeping this patient on sunitinib. Normally, though, we like to switch medications to something different if there's some evidence of clinical progression. So there's been some largely institutional experiences that have shown small amount of tumor regression and stabilization of disease with sorafenib after sunitinib, but there hasn't been any proven benefit. It's pretty much been practiced because they're available, and so there's a tendency to go one from another, but there's no good formal data that patients benefit.
So there's the two trials that are now underway. One is a comparison of second-line sorafenib versus second-line axitinib. That's called AXIS, I believe. And the other trial is sorafenib versus temsirolimus. Again, there has to be objective progression, and I don't know if CNS progression qualifies. Central nervous system progression is probably simply a sanctuary site. As you said, the patient had no progression of disease elsewhere. So I think I'd probably agree with Bob that whether you stay on sorafenib or switch to sunitinib, or vice versa, probably didn't have a major effect on the patient's outcome.
What about temsirolimus off study? And what do we know about responses after the TKIs?
Well, it's a low level of response. The best we can say is that it's been studied anecdotally. There's nothing other than small phase 2 studies for after TKI therapy. And in some cases, it was two separate TKIs. In other words, Sutent followed by sorafenib. The best data are from the new mTOR inhibitor, and I should let Bob talk about that.
Yeah, Bob, you presented at ASCO on that. Can you talk about that study?
Yeah, that was with everolimus, which is a orally administered mTOR inhibitor. It's very similar to temsirolimus with regard to proposed mechanism of action and structure, but it's given orally. And so we did a large randomized phase 3 trial in patients who had had a tyrosine kinase inhibitor and progressed one, either sorafenib, sunitinib, or both, compared to placebo. And it showed that there was an improvement in progression-free survival from 4+ months down to 1.9 months with the everolimus compared to placebo.
Where do you see that agent heading, everolimus, and how is it similar or different from temsirolimus?
Well, I think that it's got high-level evidence now, level 1 evidence in patients who have progressed on a tyrosine kinase inhibitor therapy. So it's going to have an established role there. The patient population was varied. There were some that were heavily pretreated, and some only had one prior treatment with sunitinib or sorafenib. So I think that it could be used widely under different clinical circumstances, basically for any patient who's had a tyrosine kinase inhibitor and progressed. My own feeling is that it should probably be used preferentially second line in patients who have progressed following sunitinib rather than sorafenib at this time, because we really don't have any evidence that sorafenib helps those patients, where now there is a high level of evidence of an mTOR inhibitor helping patients after TKI failure.
So, Nick, what would you be thinking if this patient progresses then on sorafenib?
Oh, definitely go to an mTOR inhibitor. Most likely the drug that you'll use is temsirolimus. Torsil is available, and whether there's really any difference, as Matthew and I were talking about at lunch, whether there's any difference between those two agents is unclear. Clinically, they have the same spectrum of toxicity. One is IV, one is oral, but I suspect they're going to be very similar. So that would be the next step if this patient has objective progression.
Dave, do you have any questions about this patient?
No, I think that was my thought process in terms of what to do next when he progresses.
You mentioned axitinib. Can you talk a little bit about what it is and where it's heading?
Sure. Axitinib is a more powerful, or at least appears to be a slightly more selective inhibitor of the VEGF and PDGF pathway. So it has a different spectrum of toxicity. It has a more substantial degree of hypertension. It has to be taken on an empty stomach twice a day, 5 milligrams. It has more nausea and a typical slightly different spectrum than sunitinib.
Okay.